We're going to open the Rules Committee, and I thank you all for being here. Just a few changes so people know on the docket for today. We're going to start with 2414 because we have a senator here who has another committee that he's responsible to be in, and so we felt we should go with that one. We will then do 2580, then 2095, and we're going to postpone 2092. So if you came here specifically for 2092, it's going to be pushed out probably to Friday. So that's kind of the order of the day, and I just wanted to let people know what's happening. So with that, we will open a public hearing on 2414. And we'll start with a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. HB 2414 adds provisions to ORS 254.135, allowing ballots to list the names of not more than two political parties that have nominated a candidate for election. It adds provisions specifying that when a candidate is nominated by a party to which the candidate belongs and one or more other parties, the name of the candidate's party and one other party selected by the candidate shall be listed. State law currently allows the name of only one party to appear opposite the name of a candidate for public office. Nomination by multiple parties was previously allowed in Oregon. In Timmons versus Twin Cities Area New Party, a 1997 U.S. Supreme Court case, a Minnesota law was upheld that prohibited nominations by more than one party against a constitutional challenge based on the rights of association under the First and 14th Amendments. However, Timmons did not prohibit multi-party nominations, which are currently used in a number of states. And that's my summary.
Thank you very much. And with that, we have our first panel. So I'll let you each introduce yourselves, and I want to thank you for being here. With that, Senator.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, colleagues. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. It's really a pretty straightforward piece of legislation that would create an opportunity for parties who have invested in candidates to appear on the ballot with the candidate's name, thus making their support known for that candidate to the voter. The proposed change would allow candidates who are nominated by more than one political party a maximum of two party identifiers to be printed next to their names on the general election ballot. Well, for example, if you take Ben Westman, he would be listed or would have been listed as a Democratic and independent candidate. Why is this important? Party labels do convey additional meaningful information to voters about a candidate. The candidates have a right for support from multiple parties to be presented on the ballot, and as we know, there's an increasing number of folks in the electorate that are choosing to be unaffiliated, not necessarily members of the independent party, but unaffiliated and members of minor parties. Voters have a right to full information about the nominations from multiple parties, and that should appear on the ballot when that occurs. And political parties have a right of free association with candidates on the ballot. That's a fundamental principle, I think, that we would all uphold. To classify this bill as fusion voting, I think, would be incorrect, and I believe Sal Peralta would be more informed about that. So, colleagues, I think this is a bill that is worthy of your consideration and would hope that we could move it forward. And I do very much appreciate the opportunity to go first on your agenda, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for being here, and in deference to that, so you can leave. We'll ask some questions if anybody has any questions of our senator. Are there any questions? It looks like they're going to leave that to other people to answer. So,
thank you
very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, you will note that I am one of the chief sponsors of this bill. I don't think I need to repeat the arguments of the good senator, except to say that I think it's time that we gave more information to voters I think it's time that this association sort of becomes more transparent to the voters, and this is the best way that I can think of to do it. It doesn't hurt our two-party system, but I think it helps voters who are somewhat disenfranchised at this point. We know that there's a large percentage of voters who are not freely associating with any party, the non-aligned voters, if you will. And so I think this is a way of reaching out to them in some way and giving them more information, better information on their on their ballots. So I would support this bill. I'm going to come back up there if there's no questions and sit down up there and let Mr. Peralta, who has really worked this bill and done a good job, give you the nuts and bolts. So there's no questions.
Come on back and join us.
Distinguished Chair, honorable representatives, my name is Sal Peralta, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Independent Party of Oregon in favor of HB 2414. I'd like to thank Senators Morris and Monroe, as well as Representatives Buckley and Berger, for agreeing to be chief sponsors on this legislation, as well as Senators Metzger, Haas, Boquist, Walker, and Whitsitt, and Representatives Edwards, Cannon, Garrard, and Bruin for agreeing to be co-sponsors. As written, this bill proposes a change to ORS 254.135, subsection 3, which will allow candidates who are nominated by more than one political party or cross-nominated to have a maximum of two-party labels printed next to their names on the general election ballot. I would like to offer two amendments to this bill at the request of Secretary Brown. The first amendment is to increase the maximum number of cross-nominating parties to three. The second amendment, which I've provided in written form, is some language that directs the Secretary of State to present to the 2011 legislature a study on how cross nominations are printed on the ballot in other states so that we may revisit the issue at that time. These amendments are intended to encourage proponents of House Bill 2580 to sign on to this bill rather than pursuing House Bill 2580 in this session. Our attorney, Linda Williams, who's here with me now, has provided in her written testimony a history of how party labels of cross-nominated candidates have been printed on the ballots in Oregon and a description of why these reforms are necessary. I've also circulated a one-page brief to the committee that describes the changes we're proposing, so I'm not going to take much time addressing those issues in this testimony. I would, however, like to mention a few brief points. The existing costs of the bill can be absorbed into existing budgets, as at least that's what has been indicated to us to this point. Second, what we're asking for can be accomplished on software that is already in place at the county level and with only minor modifications to the software run by the Secretary of State. The bill, prior to amendment, had the support of the county clerks, and it is supported by the Secretary of State. And the bill is primarily a clarification of existing Oregon statute, which we believe already requires these cross nominations to be printed. Finally, the bill settles, to the satisfaction of all parties concerned, a legal dispute between the Secretary of State and the Independent Party of Oregon and the Working Families Party and their candidates who sought in 2008 to have their cross nominations printed in the Oregon voters pamphlet and on the ballot. As to why this bill is necessary, it brings Oregon law into greater agreement with federal law as it relates to the formation of state party committees to support federal candidates nominated by one or more political parties. It brings greater respect for the free association rights of minor political parties and their candidates. In 2008, the Independent Party of Oregon spent thousands of dollars promoting its cross-nominated candidates, and the fact that these cross-nominations were not recognized in the voters pamphlet nor on the ballot may have caused confusion on the part of voters who wanted to select the Independent Party candidate. It will likely reduce confusion on the part of those who seek to administer our elections. In 2008, Joel Haugen, who won the Republican nomination in the 1st Congressional District with more than 70% of the vote, was forced to withdraw his Republican nomination in order to appear on the ballot as the candidate of the Independent Party of Oregon. This resulted in a $43,000 cost to the state when the Elections Division erroneously listed him as a Republican nominee in the voters' pamphlet in the 1st Congressional District. It's important to remember that political parties have been allowed to cross-nominate candidates for the state's entire history, and for most of the history, these cross nominations have been printed on the ballot. It is also important to remember that candidates must accept the nomination of a political party in order to be a nominee of that party. and that this bill provides candidates with the option of what cross-nominations to have printed on the ballot. Thanks for your consideration of the bill, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
So, are there any questions, Sal? Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal, the focus is on independent, but if you won both the Republican and the Democratic and the independent nomination in a primary, then on the general ballot, as I understand it, with your amendment, you would have an R, a D, and an I behind your name. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Now, on the way, we don't know exactly how this is going to show up on a ballot. Is that correct? So, I mean, it could be, will it just be one place to fill in for the one candidate with the three nominations,
right,
say, down below it?
I have a copy of a ballot from the director of the Washington County Elections printed for us, which has an example of what it might look like on the software that they use. And it's my understanding that the software that's used, and the clerks will testify to their impression, but it's my understanding that that is used on 33 out of the 36 counties in Oregon, everyone but Yamhill, Lane, and Marion. So it would be printed, I assume, in this fashion on the ES&S, the current software that's being
used. So each candidate would have only one box to fill in?
Correct.
Yay or nay.
Okay. And this is different than the proposal that you'll hear later, House Bill 2580, which is fusion voting. Under a fusion voting system, every party has its own nominating line, and one candidate may appear under multiple party lines. So you might have Representative Roblin, candidate of the Democratic Party, the Independent Party, the Republican Party, et cetera, on individual lines. Our proposal would just aggregate those onto a single line.
Okay. Do you have anything you want to share?
Oh, Honorable Chairman and committee members, I think Mr. Peralta has covered this.
Your name.
I'm Linda Williams. I'm chair of the Independent Party, and I've been one of the principal attorneys in the litigation matter and in discussing what the current bill, what the current law means and what this bill would do, which we think is perhaps clarifies existing law and then adds additional transparency and additional help to the voter. I just want to reiterate a couple of points that Sal made, if I may. One is, of course, this does not change the current law, which has required since the 1880s, when the state took over the printing of ballots, took that role away from the parties. It has always been the law in Oregon that the candidate's name appears but once. It had been the law for the great majority of the 100 years involved that the candidate's name appeared but once, but in fact, the name of the candidate was followed by all of the parties that had nominated him and or her. And back in the day, there were, of course, a robust number of additional minor parties. There were very strong populists and farm labor parties. And so all of those names did appear, and we give a couple of examples in my testimony. There was a period of time where the party identifying label was reduced to one, a single identifier. But at all times, the law has been that the candidate's name appears but once. And so we're returning really to the historical tradition and what probably fits well with Oregon's tradition of voter information at that critical point when a voter is looking at the voter's pamphlet or the ballot. So to just reiterate that point, this does not change current law in that particular respect. Also, it does not in any way affect nomination. Nomination is something that's accomplished by statute. For those of you who have run in partisan primaries, Republicans and Democrats must run in primaries. Independent, those candidates who are not affiliated at all with a party can get on the ballot by petition, and they show up as NAVs, and minor parties such as Libertarians, Greens, Independents, Working Families usually hold a convention of some sort. In any case, there must be a formal filing with the Secretary of State whereby the candidate, however he or she has been nominated, accepts that nomination. This is not an endorsement. This is not the looser process of endorsements that you're, of course, all familiar with from the voter pamphlet statements. This is a important and legally significant step of nomination, and we can't foist our nomination on someone who is unwilling to accept it. As a minor subset of that, a minor party who wishes to support a federal candidate, such as a congressperson or a Senate candidate, has to become recognized by the Federal Elections Committee as a lawful state party committee for the purposes of federal election law. Now, you can be a legitimate minor political party in Oregon by satisfying Oregon requirements, but in order to be recognized as an entity that can lawfully support a federal candidate, one has to currently show, the party has to show, and I've had this experience back in the fall, that the candidate not only meets the criteria of a federal candidate, but that the party name will appear on the ballot with the candidate. And as the current law is written, that would be prohibited. So in just as an example, a federal candidate of the Independent Party this past election cycle was Jeff Merkley, and we were unable to obtain a letter ruling, an advisory opinion from the Federal Election Committee that recognized us as the state party committee lawfully able to expend expenditures on Mr. Merkley's campaign. So this would solve that problem because I think it's an inadvertent problem that was not meant to forbid minor parties from engaging in federal election processes. And if a minor party, for example, focused entirely on congressional candidates, it would have that problem. Another thing that the bill does not do is it does not in any way affect current Oregon law about how a minor party maintains its status as a minor party. That statute, that status maintenance requirement, was dealt with rather extensively back in 1995, and those remain unchanged. They are a combination of either registered voters or a combination of registered voters plus a percentage garnered in a statewide contest. And so the mere fact that multiple names may appear will have no effect on whether or not suddenly a minor party has piggybacked and maintains its status without actually having some registration support. So, again, I would just thank the committee for its time in letting me reemphasize those kind of lawyerly points. And if I've confused anybody and you have more questions, I'm still here.
Thank you for that. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either of you, could you clarify whether or not this bill allows a minor party to nominate more than one candidate in the same race? So, say, the Democratic candidate and the state representative race and the Republican candidate, could the independent parties put their stamp of approval on both, in which case it's more of an endorsement?
No, Representative Edwards, that's not possible. State law requires that a political party may nominate one candidate for each partisan office that's on the ballot. And so that was the distinction that you've noted that I was trying to draw between endorsement and the legally significant term of nomination. A second nomination or an attempt at a nomination would simply be void. It would be contrary to state law.
Thank you.
And I guess the other last question I have for you, Sal. We have Amendment-1, and that's the one that's already written. And you talked about a second one, and that is in drafting form right now. We don't have a copy of that. Or is that a separate bill?
No, Representative Roblin. What you have are the...
They're both in here?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. And we should all have a copy of that amendment, hopefully, in your packet of materials today. Thank you both. Jan Coleman and Georgette Brown.
Yes, 2414-1. Yes.
Good afternoon, and pull the microphones close. It makes it easier for people in the back in particular to hear. Thank you.
Chairman Rowland, committees, good afternoon. I'm Georgette Brown, and I'm representing the Oregon County Clerks Association. I'm a retired county clerk. Okay, we do support this bill because we find that it is, we will be able to work with it with having two names on with no problem on most of the systems that are in Oregon, on all the election systems that are in Oregon. Now, any more than two, we're not sure about. So we do want to say that we support this bill, but without the amendments.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, county clerks met in conference last week in Salem, and we did go over this bill. We also were presented what we thought were the amendments, so we did have the opportunity to say that there could be a three put in instead of two. And the clerks backed the position with two. And again, to reiterate what Georgette said, it is because, and actually there are 32 counties on one form of system and four counties that have different ones. There are actually three different ballot counting systems represented in the state, and one that is similar to one of them, but is an old version that is no longer supported. So in essence, we went with the two because we didn't want to put a hardship on some county that we didn't know for sure if they could support the three.
Questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 32 counties can support three, but there's a couple of counties you're not sure if they can support three. Is that your...
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Mine was the same question. So if the other three or four counties can support it, then it's not a problem from the perspective. We just don't know right now.
Chair Roblin, we're not sure. The other thing is it may not be pretty because right now we're kind of having to do it with a workaround in order to add those names. So if you don't care if it's pretty, we may be able to do it. We're not sure.
Or if your name is split or something like that.
Some of them wrap, you know. Yeah. In other words, working families. Something of that sort.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you both for being here.
Really
Thank
quick
you.
Comment.
Oh, wait. A comment?
Yeah, what? Just really quickly. I don't care if it's pretty as long as it's clear.
But
will it be clear?
May I answer?
Yes. Yes.
Chairman and Representative, it may be in very, very small letters. So, as far as clarity, it could be in very small letters.
I think the concern that he's really addressing is, will you know who the candidate and what's associated with them and which box to fill in?
Yes, that will be, except that the names of the candidates could be,
smaller.
The parties could be
small.
Very small as far as the printing on it. But, of course, if they're in the voter's pamphlet, people will have all the information in the voter's pamphlet of, whoever is supporting them.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Barbara Dudley and looks like Ashley Alves. Hi, Barbara. It's great to have you here.
We're actually here to testify on HB 25.
It'll be coming up right after this one.
Okay.
We have a representative we're waiting for as well for that one.
Yes. So, as I understand it, you've called us up here to respond on 2414 on the amendments, or are we waiting to start on
2414? Because you signed up on the sign-up sheet, and it's the open hearing right now. We will have the other hearing later. So this one is 2414.
Okay. Well, was a misunderstanding.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I do have some comments on the amendments to 2414.
That would be fine.
Which I can do now, although they flow kind of more elegantly after I do my testimony on 2580, but I'll do that.
We will rearrange our brains and get that when it's done.
Because we have been in constant conversation with the proponents.
Oh, for the record. Name.
Oh, Barbara Dudley. Excuse me. Thank you. I'm co-chair of the Working Families Party. We have been in conversation, obviously, with the proponents of 2414. 2580 is a bill that we have identical to one that we've had in the last two sessions. We have worked with them on the amendments. We believe that it may be a way forward, and particularly not just the three rather than two, but the second part of that amendment that's in front of you, which is that the Secretary of State shall conduct a general review of the adoption of a cross-nomination system, and then may assess similar laws in other states and report conclusions back to the legislature. To us, that's very important because we believe that full fusion is a better system for what we're trying to accomplish, which is to give the voters more information and more choices. But we see this as a way to get us halfway there and educate the voters and the county clerks and the Secretary of State on whether or not this actually works in Oregon, as it used to back 100 years ago. So we see this as an intermediate step. Whether the Secretary of State will see it that way or not, or whether the legislature will see it that way or not, is up to you, obviously, and not us. But we do see it as a possible step in the right direction. So while we would prefer our bill, and I'll give that testimony any minute now, I also think that this would be a very reasonable beginning.
Thank you. Any questions? We'll probably get you a few more on the other bill.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Should we wait for the representative?
Yes, we will wait for that one, and we'll open a different hearing. This one is just on. Yeah.
Okay. I would just echo what Ms. Dudley said.
Your name first.
Ashley Albies.
Okay.
Thank you.
Barry Pack and Michael. How do I say that, Michael?
Salvaggio.
I always, before I say it, I just like to get it right.
Whichever would like to go first.
Michael.
Chair Rogan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the
Office of the State Treasurer. I'm here today to convey State Treasurer Ben Westland's support of House Bill 2414. A lot of my testimony has already been communicated to you from other individuals, but I'll just read what I've got. Decisions made by voters who represent them as to who represents them in Salem obviously have far-reaching implications, and when you make investments, the more information you have, the better your results are. Voters who have access to more information results in better policy for the state, we believe. We also believe that House Bill 2414 fixes an unclear statute, and in getting voters more information, we feel that this brings about good public policy, good bill should pass. And that's really all I have, and I'll stay up here for questions. Thank you.
Then we can have questions for both of you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Pack. I'm the Deputy Secretary of State. And I'm here to express the Secretary's support for House Bill 2414. I appreciate Mr. Peralta's clarification about the difference between fusion voting and this bill, which deals with cross-nomination. The Secretary of State does support fusion voting, but thinks that there are some difficulties in implementing that at this point in time, and appreciates the advocates coming together and putting forth this bill, which she does view as a first step, a good step forward, and a way for us to provide voters more information. More information when voting is always better, and by putting the party label of all of the parties that have nominated an individual candidate right there on the ballot, even if it's small, does provide more information to voters. And we've seen an increasing rise in the activity level of minor parties and the interest of multiple parties in nominating more than one candidate, or I'm sorry, more than one party nominating a candidate. We've heard from at least four parties who've expressed interest in that. So that leads me to the Secretary of State's support for the Dash 1 amendments. Obviously, there has to be some limit on the amount of information you print on a ballot, or it becomes too long and you actually confuse voters more than you educate them. But it seems that two, given there are at least four parties interested in this, is a little restrictive. Three is a little bit better. We understand that the county clerks are uncertain whether all of their systems can support it. We'd be willing and happy to work with them to clarify that and see if we couldn't come up with a way around or a way to make that work. But we think as a matter of policy, three is a better number than just two. And we'd also be more than happy to take a look at how it works after its first go-around and come back to you with some recommendations. We did that just this last year with House Bill 3270, which required a post-election hand count. And we went back and studied that, and you'll be hearing shortly some recommendations that come back from that on ways to make that more efficient and more effective. So we always welcome the chance to take a look at anything new and report back. Finally, one issue that I think is still out there, Representative Edwards raised a little bit about the way the ballot would look. I think there are some questions still outstanding that we would work through with the counties and the advocates and establish by rule. There may be an interest among voters to know what is the party affiliation of the candidate themselves, regardless of what other parties have nominated them. So there may be a way by rule we can say you bold the party that the candidate is affiliated with, or it's the first one listed. There could be other ways of solving that problem, because voters look to party affiliation as one clue or one piece of information when they make up their minds as to whether or not what sort of values and philosophies and principles a candidate approaches. So even if multiple parties nominate a candidate, there may be interest among voters to know which party that candidate is registered with. And so we thank you for your consideration and happy to answer questions.
So any questions for these witnesses? I see none. And so thank you both for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That takes care of the list of people for 2414. Is there anybody else out there who would like to speak to it who is currently there but didn't get signed up? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2414. And committee members, on this one, really look carefully at the amendments. When we come forward to do a work session or whatever, that will be one of the issues that we'll take care of. And we will also be checking into the issue that was last discussed with regard to how do we identify the candidate's party. So between now and when we have the next hearing on that bill. At this time, we will open a hearing on House Bill 2580. And with that, we'll have a short introduction about 2580 from our committee administrator, Jerry Watson.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 2580 requires general or special election ballots to list the name of candidates for each nomination the candidate receives. Requires the name of each political party that nominated candidate to be printed opposite the listing of candidate's name, and provides that votes cast for candidate on a ballot line marked for that identification or party count towards minor political party formation vote requirement. State law currently allows the name of only one party to appear opposite the name of a candidate for public office. Nomination by multiple parties was previously allowed in Oregon. Previous bills previously have been introduced that are either identical or very similar in wording to this ballot or House bill. And that's my summary.
Thank you very much, and I see that Representative Shields is here, so we'll have him come up first. If you would like anybody else to come with you at the same time, let me know. And
this is good for now.
Okay.
You can jump in the list.
They're all on the list, so the rest of them are on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for seeing me first. I'm in the midst of a quite heated discussion in the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and as much as I'd like to stay here, actually I would, I do
want to stay back. Well, we can have lots of questions, you don't know.
I might be more publicly safe here than in the other committee. For the record, again, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland, District 43 in the Oregon House of Representatives. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2580, but also it's my understanding that House Bill 2414 is likely to be moving, so I wanted to also let you all know that I'm supportive of that effort as a good first step. I am proud to have been endorsed by the Democratic Party. Been proud to have been endorsed by the Working Families Party of Oregon in the last election cycle, and I think that's important because, in my view, fusion voting cuts through and clarifies where candidates stand on key issues. It encourages the formation of genuine coalitions on important issues, and it provides voters with an exciting new tool to help legislators know which issues the voters care about most without diminishing the value of that third-party vote by voting for a third-party candidate who may have difficulty actually winning in our current system. Fusion voting is a simple reform that permits more than one party to nominate the same candidate. Now, the great advantage to fusion is that it encourages independent voters to participate without diminishing the value of their votes. Votes for a single candidate from the different parties are tallied separately and then combined for that candidate's total. Fusion is America's version, in my view, of proportional representation, encouraging the formation of coalitions before rather than after the election. This bill strengthens independent voting and voting by minority parties. And in New York and Connecticut, two states where fusion is legal and used frequently, experience and research demonstrate that fusion helps engage infrequent voters, younger voters, and other groups most alienated from the political process. Fusion also increases candidate accountability and therefore encourages voter participation because candidates will have a clearer view of who elected them and why they elected them. Fusion cuts through and clarifies, and again, Mr. Chair, I encourage support for House Bill 2580 and, of course, support the compromise House Bill 2414 as a good first step in that direction.
Thank you. Any questions for the representative? Seeing none, we'll leave that to the group that's behind you. So
thanks for having me.
Thank you. So let's start. We'll just go down the list. Jan Coleman, we'll let you come on up first with the clerks.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm representing, I'm Jan Coleman. I am a retired county clerk also, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I have the privilege of talking for the third session on this subject. So a lot of the information we're presenting to you, some of you may have been on committees before where you were exposed to this. fusion voting presents the county clerks with a major fiscal problem, and we want you to be totally aware of that. Part of this on the back page of what I presented to you is a fiscal estimate that was done for the 2008 session, the short session, and you will notice that it could trigger the Section 15, Article 11, Oregon Constitution unfunded mandate. And that is because in order to perform fusion as the process requires, our machines now are programmed to kick out overvotes so that we can look at overvotes and determine whether they are truly an overvote. Someone has voted more than one, say they voted two in a vote for one race is an overvote. Or actually if they've tried to erase, and we can determine that in Oregon. If we can determine that, then the ballot can be enhanced to count just the one vote correctly. If you're voting fusion, we would be up against a problem where we have some races that it would indicate it was an overvote, but it really isn't. And then we have other races that are not partisan, that are not going to be voted with fusion, and they truly are overvote races. So software definitely needs to be changed. The other thing that we really would have to do is educate our voters, because while proponents indicate that this is not a problem, overvoting would be a problem. Believe me, it's a problem today for us. And so we see that this, even if we educate voters, would be a huge problem to overcome. One of the big things that we consider as part of the cost would be educating these voters, and as you can see, the estimate came out to about $750,000 statewide. And even at that, we don't know how successful we'd be. This, upon counties who are already facing problems, as well as the state, with a fiscal downturn and the ONC timber problem. Some of the counties undoubtedly would have to upgrade hardware as well as software, and that estimate comes in big also. The estimate last time for Lane County alone was about $350,000 to do that. If we didn't do these upgrades, we figure we'd have to do hand counts of ballots, and low estimate on a hand count would be about $60,000. One of the things that you need to be aware of is some of the other states, they say they don't have so much problem with overvote, and that is because in most of those states, they vote at a polling place where many of those have a chance to insert a ballot. The ballot can, at a precinct place, and it will indicate whether it's overvoted at that point. And the voter can actually fix the ballot, vote a new ballot, whatever, at that point. With vote by mail, we don't have that privilege, so we would be facing more of an overvote challenge. Back on the back, you will see the fiscal, and you also see a sample of what a fusion ballot looks, just a little bitty bit of it there. But it shows you that the person appears on the ballot multiple times with different party listings.
Do we have any questions for this witness? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we have heard this before, so yes. With that, I will call up Barbara Dudley, Ashley Albies, and Dan Meek. Might as well have all of you. There's three chairs. Unless you want to come afterwards, Dan. The three of them is fine.
Ashley, you're going to go first?
Yeah, I will begin.
And welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to see everybody again. Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for holding this hearing and giving us the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2580, a bill to restore fusion in Oregon, introduced by Representatives Buckley and Shields. My name is Ashley Albies, as I said before. I'm a proud member of the Oregon Working Families Party, and I was the Working Families Party candidate for Attorney General in the most recent election. I received over 161,000 votes, almost 11% of the total votes cast for Attorney General in that election. I've always felt that fusion voting offers our best hope to engage the next generation of citizens, and my election results have reinforced this belief. As you know, John Kroger received both the Republican and the Democratic nominations in the Attorney General race in the last election, although only one nomination could appear on the ballot. Thus, I didn't run in a heavily contested election as a spoiler candidate. The 11% I did receive, which we know because the Working Families Party had its own ballot line, demonstrates that when voters are given a choice to vote for a minor party candidate who will not be a spoiler, they will take that opportunity and do so. The platform of the Working Families Party resonated with voters across the state. As Ms. Dudley will testify, approximately 20% of voters in this state are not affiliated with either of the major parties. Fusion offers these voters a real choice to vote for a candidate based on issues that matter to them most, without wasting that vote on a candidate that cannot win. My 11% further demonstrates that the voters will unite and vote for an economic platform that resonates with them, especially in rural counties. For example, I got 16 to 17% of the vote in Klamath, Umatilla, Coos, and Harney counties. Another point I would like to make very briefly, as a member of a younger generation of voters, in previous elections, younger voters felt disengaged and alienated from the political process, and had a sense that their voices and their votes just did not count. This past election was remarkable in the increase in young voter participation. We need to keep this momentum going and keep this momentum moving. And Fusion, I believe, provides one way to do so by increasing the choices that are available to voters. Mine is a generation that communicates mostly through messaging, whether it's instant messaging, text messaging, Facebook messaging, and Fusion allows voters to send a message with their votes, signaling to candidates which issues matter the most to them. And because Fusion gives us the option of voting for a candidate with an actual chance of winning, we can dramatically increase voter effectiveness by eliminating the problem of the spoiler vote. While we certainly want more voters exercising their right to vote, we want them to do so because they feel that it actually makes a difference. Survey data from Fusion Legal States demonstrates that Fusion-based parties appeal to young voters with irregular voting behavior and limited partisan identification. Fusion provides the opportunity for disengaged Oregonians to get involved in the political process in a constructive and creative fashion, to cast votes that reflect their priorities while supporting a candidate with an actual chance of winning. So for these reasons, I urge you to pass a Fusion bill in this legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you. Shall we wait until the whole group and then ask questions of any and all of them? Or is there a question that people have right now that's burning?
Thank you, Chairman Roblin and members of the committee. My name, again, is Barbara Dudley. I am co-chair of the Working Families Party. I'm also an adjunct professor at the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State and a partner in Bethel Heights Vineyard. A farm in Polk County, right across the river here. And thank you not only to Representatives Buckley and Shields, who sponsored this legislation, but also on this committee, Representatives Roblin and Berger, and then a number of other representatives and senators. Fusion voting is a very simple electoral reform, which gives minor parties the option to cross-nominate a candidate from a major party. And with fusion voting, each party's nomination is listed separately. If the candidate supports their issues and accepts their nomination, the party can then nominate the candidate on their party line so that the voter has a choice of party as well as candidate. The votes for a cross-nominated candidate are tallied separately and then added together for that candidate's total. Fusion voting was legal throughout the country in the 19th century. Today, fusion voting is legal in 7 states and used actively in 4, New York, Connecticut, South Carolina, and Delaware. The latter 3 states have fairly recently begun using fusion voting. It is the experience of election officials and voters in those states that fusion is a fairly simple, straightforward voting method that's easily understood by the voters and not terribly burdensome to election officials. In the last legislative session here, we presented testimony from other jurisdictions to this effect in support of an earlier fusion bill. When fusion was legal in Oregon in the 19th century, it provided a way for rural and urban voters to come together on issues which they shared in common. Economic issues which affected family farmers, lumbermen, urban wage earners alike. This is an era when we could very much use that same common voice, when rural and urban Oregonians need to come together to find solutions to the issues that plague this state, from the budget shortfalls, unemployment, credit freezes, mortgage foreclosures, as well as land use planning and health care reform. Fusion voting is not the solution to all that ails the state, but it is part of the solution. With fusion ballots, voters can focus on the issues which unite them, not on the issues which divide. Voters can vote with the party which best represents their views on issues while making a coalition with other voters in other parties to support a particular candidate. That way, the voters can make their views known, and the candidates and the legislators can have a more accurate view of what their constituents want and expect. The people of this state do not all fit neatly into one of the two major parties. As you know, over 25% of them still are not affiliated with either major party. And only 67 to 70%, and I'm not sure where it ended up after the last rash of registrations, of voting age population is registered to vote at all. Oregon voters can be very thoughtful. They certainly are opinionated. And yet, under the current system, they can only participate in the electoral process in a consequential way if they vote Republican or Democrat. Most Oregonians clearly want more choices but don't want to throw their vote away and don't want to be spoilers. Fusion gives them this opportunity while focusing their attention and that of the legislators whom they elect on the issues which matter most to them. Not all minor parties will exercise the option to fuse with a major party candidate. Some will continue to run standalone candidates. Some parties will sometimes fuse and sometimes run independent candidates. But the fusion option means that the possibility of compromise and coalition is available, and that option makes it more likely that compromise can be reached in the legislature. Many proposals have been under consideration here in Oregon. We have been discussing fusion voting now in three legislative sessions. We've had the discussion about the potential costs or lack thereof. We understand that the budget is your primary concern in this legislative session, and we're glad that that is so. We do not want to get into an argument with the clerks about whether or not we can accomplish this in a more expensive or less expensive way, or how much education will or won't cost. We believe it is sensible to leave that to the Secretary of State's office to explore. And for that reason, as we said, with the amendments that have been proposed, we would be willing to support also 2414 as amended, so that we can start down this path, see how it goes, see how the voters like it, see how you like it, see how the Secretary of State's office likes it, and then perhaps come back with a recommendation for full fusion, which we do believe is the more effective option.
Thank you very much. Representative Garrard.
If I may ask
sure.
a question.
Sure, right now it would be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last paragraph in the bill summary, I need you to maybe explain this a little bit for me. I'm from Klamath Falls, so I'm...
The bill summary?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It says, specifies that multiple votes for a candidate on the same ballot for the same office count as vote for that candidate only as major political party candidate.
Right.
That seems to be a little contradictory.
Well, okay, so here it was a compromise in the last legislative session. It is the overvote question that the clerks raised. So if you were nominated for two different parties and the voter voted for you on both those party lines because they really, really wanted you to win, and they thought that they needed to vote twice, or they just wanted to, or they were just contrary.
I encourage that.
I do. As they do in Chicago. excuse me, I just flew in from Chicago this morning. But if that were the case, then that overvote would go to the major party as opposed to the minor party. So...
And the vote would still be
but they only count it once.
The vote would only be counted once. It would be an overvote. It would only be counted once because to qualify for the ballot, you need to get X number of voters to vote for you in a statewide election or in a district election to qualify in that district, or you need to have X number of registered voters. And that was what it was trying to straighten out.
Thank you.
And I'll follow up with that one. And that's what they were saying in the other category. Those wouldn't count for any party except the major party, so it wouldn't have that effect.
That's right.
In the other voting tally to add, give an opportunity for a minor party to have its certification done by the vote alone,
that's
whereas
exactly
fusion
right.
would do that.
That's correct. That's exactly right. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions before we move on to our last witness so far that signed up? Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Meek. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I didn't want to miss the opportunity to state my support for this bill and for the adoption of Fusion. Both cross-nomination and Fusion provide more information to the voter. It tells the voter which parties, at least up to three under House Bill 2414, support each candidate. But the difference is that Fusion enables voters to communicate more information to elected officials. And therefore, I believe it is preferable to cross-nomination. It allows a voter to convey to really convey a very effective message that is not captured with cross-nomination alone. Thank you.
Question. Other questions? Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So following up on that line of thought, and I agree it does convey more information to candidates and to elected officials. As I've been sitting here thinking about this, it occurs to me that while it will give more information to, or it certainly gives more choice to the voter, which I think is a good thing, I'm a little bit concerned that it could produce the result of, say, legislators in our instance coming to the Capitol and they know exactly where their base is, their voter base. Say it's Working Families Party, or say it's Green Party, or say it, and that those legislators could tend to get more entrenched and a little bit less
compromising.
Compromising is the word I'm looking for. And compromise is what moves the process forward. And while I don't like that fact at times, it is a fact of the legislative process anyway. So I want some feedback about that thought, because I've thought about this for a while. And what are your thoughts about that?
Could I respond?
Yes.
First of all, I don't think that's any different than the current situation. At the moment, legislators come here knowing where their base is. It just is either Democrat or Republican. What this does, actually, I believe, is to broaden the base, and that is the experience in New York, because you're coming in, you would come in as, say, Democrat Working Families, maybe even Democrat Working Families Green, or Democrat Working Families Libertarian, or something else. The experience in New York State is that it actually encourages people to come together around issues, because those issues are carried into the campaign via this coalition that's being built. And it moves you more toward that sort of compromise. Even now, you can't have the Democrat and Republican nomination on the ballot, which would say something to the voters as well as to the legislators. There are many who get both nominations through this write-in process that you all engage in this strange fashion. So you come in with both nominations, but you really don't, because what you've been voted for on the ballot is either Democrat or Republican. So, you know, there's a lot of complaint about the partisanship of the caucuses and so on. This would scramble the caucuses in an interesting way. And I don't know how you all feel about that, but from our point of view out here, as voters and as minor party representatives, it would be a good thing.
Thank you for that good response.
Anything from either of the others?
Dan Meek, responding, Representative Edwards. It seems to me that what you have said is sort of an argument to go ultimately with nonpartisan elections. That would be sort of the ultimate flexibility and give representatives the ultimate ability to compromise, because it basically would de-link them from the identity of their constituents in a way, and in fact, I think, reduce accountability. With folks, a lot of folks, you know, working two jobs when they can find them and spending the rest of their time looking for work, Many voters rely very heavily on party identification, and many studies show that it is certainly the single most influential and important piece of information that voters have when they cast their votes. And I think it does mean, I think party labels do mean something, and that that if you have more party labels and more opportunity to express preference for a particular party with a known agenda, like I think the Libertarians have a known agenda, the Greens certainly have a known agenda, I think that will increase the accountability of elected officials to their constituents, to the folks who voted for them. And I say the opposite of that is a nonpartisan system, which I think would actually reduce accountability.
I just would echo the sentiments that have already been expressed. I think when you enter the legislature with a particular mandate from a particular population, that you have a duty to carry out the desires of that population, and the issues that they vote for are the issues that are of highest concern to them. And, you know, there's always going to be rampant partisanship, and I think this is a way to diffuse that, if nothing else.
Thank you, Ashley. And I wanted to make sure I said Ashley so that we'd know on the tape who it was.
Thank you.
Yes.
Barbara Dudley, thank you. I forgot to add one thing, which is that I'm also submitting written testimony from Adam Morse of the Brennan Center.
Okay.
And the report of the Brennan Center, which is the Center on Voting Issues at NYU Law School. And that study itself is being introduced as well, just for the record.
Did we already receive that?
Yes.
Okay. It was just, oh, there it is. Yep, found it. Representative Garrard.
Just a question of the chair. Do we have any testimony from the Republican Party or the Democratic Party in regards to this?
To this point, we have not. And if I recall last session, I don't remember we
did. No.
I don't think we did either. I don't know about the third one because I wasn't
no,
on the committee.
No, they've never testified either party on this.
But they're highly represented.
Individually represented.
And I will just point out that we did receive in the packet the study that was referred to, so it is part of the record.
Thank you.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Representative Edwards.
I wanted to make, thank you, Mr. Chair, I wanted to make one last comment because they are highly represented in the legislature. What I've struggled with as I've thought about this issue is that I guarantee that there are more than two points of view in this legislature on nearly every issue. Mm-hmm. And our process that we have set up now shoehorns us all into mm-hmm. one of these two caucuses, which, believe me, is very frustrating at times. So to the extent that changing election law and whatnot encourages a little more independence, I think that's a good thing. I'm just trying to get a feel for whether or not this actually creates more gridlock than it frees up.
Mm-hmm.
So,
just very quickly yeah. to respond, I think that's an excellent reason why we should experiment and come back and discuss it after we've tried the cross-nomination thing, and I think we'll all have more experience with it then.
And I guess the only comment I would make, and one of the reasons that for me it was an easy decision to sign on to this bill, is that, and I think all of us can think of this, when you go out and you walk and you knock on doors and you talk to people, in places like Coos County, which obviously voted in high numbers for the Working Family Party, I know there are a lot of those people. Many of them have been helpful, and you knock on the door and they do want people to hear the message that they have. I mean, so, and they let you know at the door. Independent people, party members do the same. And they know, you know, they may indicate they're going to vote for you or they're going to vote for the other person, but they clearly have ideas about what they would like and that they want to be heard. And so from my perspective, it is a way to give that message directly to the legislators who are out there knocking on those doors. Not that we haven't heard it. I will tell you, in those areas where there are these minor parties, and I'm sure that's true, the Greens are stronger up in the Portland area and others, I'm sure that they don't hesitate to make their issues clear when you meet with them. because they certainly do, at least in my area as well. So, question?
Oh, comment.
Comment, yes. Representative Jensen.
Maybe the only member of the group here qualified to comment on this particular question or this particular issue, having run as both a Republican and a Democrat, and also as an independent. So, unaffiliated would be the category that fell into. Your arguments are unpersuasive. I understand everybody's concern about the partisanship, and Representative Edwards is certainly correct in his observations about, at least as I interpreted them, the points of view and the fact that sometimes those perhaps become awkward for us to deal with. It seems to me, as a minor student of American history, that the two-party system has generally served us fairly well, and a minority party has generally served a very important function. When the minority party appears on the scene, as a real minority party, it raises a serious question that the other two parties are out of touch with some phase or aspect of the American society. Many of the changes, many of the growths, I would think, that we've had in American politics have been as a consequence of the two-party, or of the minority party. The minority party capturing a sufficient amount of enthusiasm on the part of the public in their state, and maybe expanding to multiple states, that they begin to make an impact on the legislature, if it's the legislature we're talking about, itself. Now, I can for certainty tell you that a minority party of one in a body of 60 doesn't make a very big impact. A minority party of three or four might make a larger sort of impact. But I'm not sure if I were a minority party person who thought I had a wildest chance of getting elected that I'd want to be affiliated with one or the other. Because it might be only through that minority party that I'd be able to move the agenda items that I find there's something very powerful, even for cantankerous old men, about the party system. To more or less help keep us in line. Now, you may argue when you're on the other side of those issues that that's not good. A perfectly legitimate argument. But when your argument gets good enough that you've got enough people who are minority party members, then it changes the system. I don't know. That's a I think one of the things that we are always so concerned with, and I'm thinking out loud, and I'm sorry, you're welcome to cut me off wherever you think you have heard all the
I'll give you a few more minutes.
Whether we like it or not, it depends sometimes on where we're at in the process. But the whole issue of politics is really power. Being able to influence the system the way that we individually think it should be influenced. And the party serves to be a pretty effective way of doing it. Even though I disagree sometimes vehemently with a particular political party, none to be mentioned because none of them who are here fall into that category, but I'm not convinced. I'm sorry.
Any comments?
Well, this could go on for a long time.
How long do we have?
I'd really enjoy this conversation. I mean, shall I?
Certainly. I'll give you a few moments.
Part of the problem is that fusion voting was a vehicle by which minor parties were able to begin to build strength and actually insert themselves into the political dialogue when it was legal. And that was taken away. So that now, with the first-past-the-post kind of elections that we have, there's very little room for a minor party to actually get into the discussion in any realistic way. So fusion voting, to many of us, is one vehicle, a responsible vehicle, by which you can insert minor party views into the discussion without being spoilers and making voters even more cynical than they already are by saying, yes, you can vote for the Green Party candidate, and that way you'll elect the person you least want to have in office. You know, and that is what we're trying to get around. So I agree with you in terms of minor parties sometimes can raise, and many times in our history, anti-slavery, temperance, you name it. I mean, the big issues have been raised first by minor parties, and then they become mainstream issues. But there has to be a way for that minor party to enter into the dialogue, and fusion was the way for that to happen. So, you know, it's by looking back to a time when there really was a voice for minor parties that, you know, we came to this conclusion.
I would, again, this is Ashley Albers, I would just echo that with the two-party system, you have, personally, as a voter who doesn't affiliate with either of the two major parties, I have a choice, as Barbara said, to vote for the candidate or the issue that I believe in the most, and usually that means throwing my vote away or taking my vote away from somebody between the two candidates who are going to win, and then it's a spoiler vote. So it's having your vote mean something, and I think for disengaged voters that don't affiliate with the two major parties, that further requires them to disengage even more because they feel like they're not represented in any way, shape, or form, so why bother? So this, again, I think provides a vehicle, an opportunity for those who don't affiliate with the two major parties to identify an issue and also feel like their vote counts.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Yep, Representative Noel.
I'm not very familiar with the way elections are held in the states that you talked about. Can you give me some sense of what portion of their nominees are repeat nominees? Do you end up with a situation where you still really have only two candidates on the ballot under a fusion ballot? Or do you just as often have five or six names as well as five or six parties on the ballot?
In New York and Connecticut, which are the two that use it the most, mm-hmm. the answer to that depends on whether it's state, how big an election it
okay.
is. The Working Families Party, which is the one I'm most familiar with, tends to cross-nominate for the state assembly. But they tend to run independent candidates, and used to tend to run independent candidates for city councils or county commissions or county, they call them something else, and I'm forgetting the term, but county-level government.
Townships.
Yes. And now, as they've established themselves, you know, their positions and their party, they're starting occasionally to run candidates for state assembly positions and bigger offices. So it's a question of sort of familiarizing the voters with your party and the positions of your party, and you do that by cross-nominating in elections where you wouldn't have a snowball's chance in whatever to win, and then you build your credibility, your issues, and so on.
Well, not so much a follow-up question as just a follow-up comment, that there is something appealing and valuable about helping those of us who belong to, for our independent reasons, one of the major parties, and serve, but to help us not get too comfortable in that.
I agree.
Yeah.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I think maybe one of the things that concerns me then with your argument about not being feeling like you're going to have to throw your vote away, or feeling, as I have on a number of occasions, like I wasn't voting for anyone, I was voting against somebody, sort of thing. Generally, it seems to me to tie down too often to single issue politics. And my limited experience in this body is that there's an awful lot of issues. And painful as it is to admit sometimes, I find myself wildly on the side, on one group's side, on one issue, and the next day the role has reversed. The party system, and if I'm speaking like I'm an advocate for the party system, I will accept that label, even though I run as an independent. The party system has the advantage of being something of a collective whole. I'm not going to be happy with all of it, but yeah, I got one of the loveliest wives in the world. My, there are times I'm not necessarily happy with. You know, when she comes back from Nordstrom's, I'm not sure that's something that really, you know, makes me feel all that warm and fuzzy, type of thing. So,
that's how we feel about our legislature too.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Excuse me. I'm her legislator.
Boy, it took me a long time to get there, didn't it?
Yeah.
Nice shot, Bob.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this is deteriorated a little, and my apologies to you.
That's okay. I am a firm believer in the process of the legislature, and that the only way it works is when we have people really have conversations, and it has to get down to the philosophical conversations if you want good policy. And to me, this has been a really good day here in this committee, listening to this and the previous bill, because we are talking about real things that can affect people and how they vote, how we get people to the ballots, how they get their feelings expressed. And if we don't do that, In the long run, we have the revolutionary kinds of outcomes, because people get too frustrated and they don't get the chance to express themselves. And I think that whenever we have the opportunity to have real conversations about this, it is in the best interest of our state and our citizens to have those conversations. And I appreciate the fact that you are willing to come here and put forward your views as clearly as you have, and are passionate about them. So I thank you all for being here, and I'll let you go. But is there anyone else that didn't put their name on the list that would like to speak to this? Come on up forward. I do. So, David, state your name, and this is on 2580, fusion voting.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and to the old legislature in the state. A lot of disability people can't vote because they don't know how to do it.
Be sure and give your name, David.
David Beam.
Thank you,
in
David.
In Salem, Oregon. I'm an advocate for a special needs population in the state of Oregon. A lot of them have been institutionalized most of them own no life. Some of them live in group homes, don't know how to vote. So I'm trying to do, get a system in the state, have a blind and a deaf work together to get this done. And I already talked to Peter Courtney on this, get a drop-in center to start this program in the state of Oregon. Every time I bring that up into registration, they keep nagging me down because this is being needed right now. We don't get this done. You got a lot of voters out there, disability people, can't vote. How are you going to do it? And nobody wants to show them in the state of Oregon.
And David, we had a meeting just the other day, and we talked about some of those kinds of things. And right after this meeting, if you'll wait over there, I will talk to you about some things that we're already doing, and I will continue to work with you.
And I'd like to, I put my application too, and to be on the governor's committee. He can keep denying me for being on any committee. So I want the legislature point me on something for disability people because I know I can do it. Did a good job in the state of Oregon, 4-year term.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Oh, yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you. And thank you for raising that important point that people with disabilities can and should vote. And often people with disabilities have more at stake than people without disabilities in the outcomes of each election. I think that's one of the reasons why you ran for governor.
Yes.
And thanks for coming today to share your story again.
The thing is, a lot of disability people can do the job, can do work, and live in the community. The families, a lot of them don't want to work with them, don't understand them. Now, Barbara Roberts' son, he's a disability person. Maybe he want to run for office. You don't know that. So you've got to give him a chance in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I will close our hearing on House Bill 2580. And next, and again, as people have already heard, we are not going to hear 2092, but we will open a public hearing on 2095. I'll have a short explanation from our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 2095 makes both substantive and technical changes to statutes governing the conduct of elections. It provides for a county is not required to perform post-election hand counts if the county is required to conduct a countywide recount. Adds recall elections to the state's contest of election statutes in ORS Chapter 258. Clarifies the term of office for appointment, filling a vacancy in the position of Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries. Prohibits county clerk from registering a person who alters information on the registration card regarding citizenship or the signature statement. Changes the effective date of voter registration updated under ORS 247.292 from the date the county clerk changes address information on the voter registration file to the date the county clerk receives written evidence of the change of residence or mailing address. Establishes a process for notifying persons voting challenged ballot of the nature of the challenge and an opportunity to provide evidence verifying registration. Proponents assert that existing statutory provisions dealing with the conduct of elections need both technical and substantive amendments. The proponents assert that the most significant substantive statutory provisions changed by HB 2095 would affect A, post-election hand count provisions when there is a mandatory countywide recount. B, the clarification of the BOLI term of office when vacancy is filled by appointment. And C, adding recall elections to the state contest of election statutes. Amendments have been requested since pre-session filing involving ORS 253.170 and ORS 254.529. I do not have those amendments, however, and that is my summary.
Okay, thank you very much. And with that, we will invite Brenda Bates.
Good afternoon. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the Secretary of State Elections Division. I'm here today to review with you House Bill 2095. House Bill 2095 is our general housekeeping bill that makes miscellaneous law changes for Chapters 247 through Chapters 260. I have provided a section-by-section summary for you to follow along with me as I summarize and explain each section for you. I'll try and make this as painless as possible.
Thanks.
Section 1 just adds a reference for the exception in ORS 247.125 to the amendment in Section 2. Section 2 adds provision to prohibit a person from altering any printed information on a registration card relating to attesting that they are a U.S. citizen and to the truthfulness of the information the elector has provided. Provides that if an individual alters this information, the county clerk may not register that person. The Secretary of State and county elections officials have received voter registration cards that were altered by the elector. The alterations are such that it brings into question the validity of the card. For example, an elector changes the language of the question, are you a citizen of the United States of America? Electors have altered this language by crossing out the words United States of America and replacing them with their own wording, such as America. There's been other examples as well of changing that phrase. Section 3, subsection 1, provides that the effective date of an updated registration received by an elector is the date the county elections official receives the updated information. Subsection 2 clarifies that if the county elections official receives information from the United States Postal Service on a return ballot indicating that the elector's address has changed, the effective date of that change is the date the county elections official makes the change to the elector's record. Current statute provides that the effective date is the date the county elections official changes the information. We wanted to separate that out so that if it's from the elector themselves, that would be the effective date. Section 4 clarifies that a minor political party may nominate candidates for the general election directly after qualifying as a minor political party. Once the first general election has passed, the minor party must maintain a certain number of registered voters to retain their minor party status and nominate candidates for the subsequent next election. Current law is vague as to when a minor political party may start nominating their candidates. This reflects current practice and clarifies potentially confusing language. The rest of Section 4 is conforming language from Legislative Council. Section 5 provides a candidate filing a declaration of candidacy, the amount of the required filing fee for the office of county judge who exercises judicial functions within the county. When the office of county judge was added as a candidate who filed their candidacy with the Secretary of State's office, there was not a provision that provided the filing fee for that office. It just adds that office to the filing fees. Section 6 adds a new subsection to allow the filing officer with whom a declaration of candidacy has been filed to declare the nomination vacant and allow that political party to select another candidate to fill the vacancy in nomination if it is determined that the candidate is not eligible to be elected at the general election. In the last general election, a candidate for the office of state representative was found not to be a resident of the district in which they had filed for office. Unfortunately, by the time that this was determined, the period for the political party to place the nominee on the ballot had passed, and there are no provisions in election law to allow our office to declare that nomination vacant and allow the party to provide us with a name. Section 7 provides that the secretary must include federal office on the certified ballot submitted to the county elections officials no later than the 61st day prior to the date of a primary general election. Previously, the statute only addresses congressional candidates, which do not include the office for president and United States senator. Section 8 requires that a question must also be printed on the ballot for a recall election. Statute previously only required the reasons for demanding the recall and a statement of justification to be printed on the ballot. By requiring a question to the ballot that states, do you vote to recall from the office, and clarifying what office it is clear to the voter the results of their choice of either voting yes or no. Section 9 allows a county elections official to move an elector's registration to an inactive status if the elector does not respond by the deadline provided in a county's written statement to a challenge ballot. The elector will be returned to active status once the county elections official determines the validity of the registration. County elections officials make several attempts to contact a voter whose ballot has been challenged, most commonly for non-matching of their signature. The county elections official has 10 days after an election to resolve these issues, and electors often do not respond to the notice sent by the county elections official. Placing these voters in an inactive status provides a motivation for the voter to respond because they will not receive another ballot until they contact their county and address the problem associated with that challenge. Section 10 provides that a candidate whose name is printed on the ballot may not be employed or may not volunteer to participate in the opening of ballot envelopes or in preparation of ballots to be counted for any election. This provision does not include an incumbent county clerk who is charged by law with conducting elections in Oregon. Current statute fails to include a candidate on the ballot to the list of individuals that may not be involved in processing of ballots for an election. Section 11.
That's a new one to me.
This section amends the law relating to post-election hand counts of randomly selected precincts. It directs the secretary to advise county clerks in writing of the election contests and precincts that are to be counted by hand no later than the third business day after the date of the election. Currently, the Secretary of State is required to notify counties the following day after the general election. It is possible that counties may not know the election contest within their county that has received the largest number of votes the day after the election, as ballots are still being processed. It worked out fairly good this election because it was a presidential election, so of course the president is going to receive the most votes in those counties. This section further provides that if a county is already required to conduct a hand count under ORS Chapter 258, that they would not be subject to the hand count provisions in ORS 254.529. So all that is saying is if they are already required by the law to do a hand count countywide, they would not have to also, in addition, do the hand count in 254.529. Section 12 provides that the public officer who is subject of a recall may contest the results of a recall election. Currently, there are no provisions in statute to allow for a contest of the results for a recall election. Section 13 adds provision that any elector entitled to vote for a recall election or a public officer subject to the recall may contest the results of the recall election. Section 14 provides the reasons in which a recall election may be set aside. The reasons are if the number of votes taken is reversed or if there is a non-deliberate and material error in the distribution of the ballots. Section 15 adds a new subsection that provides that a petition to contest the results of a recall election must be filed in circuit court for the county in which the filing officer authorized to order the recall election is located. Section 16 adds reference to the recall elections and the type of elections that may be contested and who would recover the cost of the election if the contestant prevails. Section 17 provides that if the recall is for the Office of Governor, Secretary of State, State Treasurer, Attorney General, Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries, Superintendent of Public Instruction, or a position of a judge on the Oregon Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, or Tax Court, a notice of the recall is not required to be published in the next available issue of a newspaper of general circulation in the county. All others are required to provide notice. Section 18 just adds Section 19 to Chapter 258. Section 19 provides that if the court sets aside the results of a recall election, a special election on the recall shall be held no later than 35 days after the date the judgment was rendered, and provides that the county or local elections official who committed the error in the distribution of the ballots shall bear the cost of the special election. Section 20 adds that a violation of 247.125(1) which is the altering of a voter registration card, is classified as a Class C felony, as any other alterations on a card currently are. Section 21 adds Section 22 to Chapter 249. Section 22 provides that if a vacancy occurs in the Office of Governor, Secretary of State, State Treasurer, Attorney General, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, or the Superintendent of Public Instruction, before the 61st day before the first general election to be held, during that term of office, the remaining 2 years of the term are filled at the general election. Current statute is not clear in regards to the term of office for nonpartisan state office that may become vacant in midterm. This change is suggested to prevent questions regarding what the new term of office for nonpartisan state office would be. And then finally, Section 23 provides the effective dates of the previous sections. If you have any questions?
It appears that we do. And I want to thank you. These are always such an interesting bills, and I'm always surprised at things that seem like, how could that possibly not have been taken care of at least the year before? So, Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Got two, if that's all right.
That would be great.
Ms. Bates, hi, thank you for being here. Why, this is in regards to Section 22. I'm wondering why the governor is included in a nonpartisan paragraph.
Tara Roblin, Representative Girard. It's the governor, secretary of state, state treasurer, attorney general. The current law currently covers all of those state offices. It did not cover the nonpartisan state offices, so we are simply adding the commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries and the superintendent of public instruction into that statute.
So the reference is simply to the additions.
That's correct.
Excuse me, Mr.
Yep, that's good.
Second question is Section 17. Could you explain why that's net? Why you would not want to publish notice of a recall?
Chair Roblin, Representative Girard, currently, if it was at a county level within a county, you would publish the notice in that county because it pertains specifically to a county office. And they are required to provide notice to the public, any kind of county office. We would have to do it statewide for a state office.
I agree.
And of course, that would be paid for out of state funds to do a statewide publication.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, by the look on Representative's face, I assume that the implication to finish her sentence here is, because I had the same question, is that the newspapers would have heard about it. I have a couple of questions, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Section 3, I'm missing something. You get a return ballot, and on the return ballot, the elector has indicated that there's a change of address. Okay. The effective date of that change is the date that it was entered in the record.
Correct.
Why is that different from current statute?
The current statute, just all the statutes specifically, well, let me read it to you. And then it probably will make sense. The statute currently says the effective date of a voter registration updated under 247.292 or 247.296 is the date that the county clerk changes the information in the voter registration file. What we are trying to do is separate that out a little bit. And if it's a yellow sticky on a return identification envelope that says this elector has moved to this address, it's not coming directly from the elector, it's coming from the Postal Service. So they would put the effective date of when they entered that information into the system. If it's coming directly from the elector who updates a voter registration card, it should be the effective date that the county received that from the elector versus receiving something from the United States Postal Service. So we're separating those two out.
I think I understand it, Mr. Chair. I'm not reading the actual bill. I'm reading the summary of the section, and that's complicated enough. I'm optimistic that the drafter has got this right. Maybe I shouldn't be.
So were there any amendments that you had to this, or is this the way you want it?
Chair Roblin, I'm not aware of any amendments to
this. Because we had heard at least some point that there were some amendments. We had a little note that just had said that Mr. Pack was looking for some.
Mr. Chair, can I indulge with one more question? On Section 20, adds that a violation, and I haven't read 247.1451, but I assume we're talking about some sort of a deliberate altering of a voter registration card, not just sort of bad handwriting, because this is a Class C felony, and if you saw my handwriting, you'd understand the problem.
Representative Berger, that's correct. It's altering the question, are you a United States citizen, or altering the language that the voter attests to, that they are swearing and affirming that the information they have provided on the voter registration card is accurate.
Thank you.
Representative Nolan, you have a look in your eye.
Yes, I do. So we want to make that a Class C felony instead of just invalidating the registration?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, it just falls within any kind of false information on the voter registration card. Is considered, if someone provides any kind of false information on the voter registration card, it's classified as a Class C felony currently. And that would just be adding that as well.
Well, when the bill gets here, we can talk about that.
Well, we have the bill. We're not going to work it today, but we do have the bill. It's 20. It's in your packet. 2095. Yeah, it's it.
I mean,
we don't play around with people messing around with their red voter registration card.
No, I guess not.
Okay.
Don't drop water on it.
That is the issue that we've got to get our heads around. But just altering it, not the information that you give, but altering the form itself could result in that is an issue. So that's what we have to get our heads wrapped around that. Yeah, it is an issue. Representative Jensen.
Is that to form all that's necessary for voting in this state?
Chair Rowland, Representative Jensen, as far as registering to vote,
yes.
You have to be registered to vote in order to cast a ballot.
Is that the only thing that's needed to be registered to vote?
That's correct.
So filling out the form.
Five times more difficult to get a driver's license than it is to register to vote.
Correct.
That's correct.
Because representative voting is a right, driving is a privilege.
That's true. Representative Jensen?
Voting is a right for citizens of the United States.
That's true. And that's why the penalties are so high. But that's
why everybody walks into the courthouse.
That's true. But that's why the penalties are so high for putting false information on that card. Because once you've done it, if you are not a citizen, you have committed a Class C felony.
Right.
I understand that. I know that that's a deterrent, but be that way.
And I'm going to allow Barry Pack to come forward to clarify for us, as it would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Barry Pack with the Secretary of State's office. I just wanted to clarify that we have asked for some amendments to this bill that have not come back from Legislative Council yet, but they address some of the recommendations that came out of the report of the post-election hand counts that I mentioned earlier today. So we hope to have them shortly. You're all aware of the workload in LC, so we're awaiting them, but we will bring them. And I'm sorry, Brenda, that I didn't inform you of that before this committee hearing. Thank you.
This doesn't seem quite consistent with the wording in section 19 at the top of the page 12 up here. And I'm wondering whether or not we ever have a situation where the local refugees was first by response, but that's what this more or less says.
Right. I'm going to get that checked out later.
Okay.
Other questions? As you can tell, we have some work to do on this bill, it appears. So we will be scheduling that in the future. There's no one else that is scheduled to testify. Is there anyone else here who would like to? Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2095. And a few comments. One, we do know that getting amendments is difficult. We have a lot of work sessions that are going to be scheduled right after the second because there's some stuff waiting. I'm not pushing any of them in this committee because we have a little bit longer, and so you haven't seen some. There's a few, including 20, the other bill that we are not hearing, 2092.
Yeah.
So we'll take a deep breath with regard to that. If anybody here, if there is others, we do have a couple bills that people have asked to have submitted as committee bills. We're running out of time for that as well. This Wednesday, there is a day that we will probably put a couple in. Friday, as of right now, we have no scheduled meeting. So, so then Monday, when we come back, is the second. It is the last day for bills to be submitted. So if you have any issues or anything you want to bring up, you need to get them considered between now and that Monday one, and that's really pushing it. So it would be better if you had it on Wednesday. So any other announcements? I don't seem to have any. Any announcements from any of the committee members? Seeing none, the Rules Committee is adjourned.